When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is the Ridiculous Ashes podcast. I'm Dan Lipke, and with me is Alex Bowden.
Hello!
We are covering historical Ashes series to find out which nation is more ridiculous at cricket. Is it England or is it Australia? And the series that we are covering this time around is the 1981 Ashes.
Yes, and we're into the fourth test now at Edgbaston. The way it works is we pick out a bunch of ridiculous moments and then we give 3, 2, and 1 points to our top three. Most points for whichever side wins the ridiculous test match, regardless of the outcome of the actual test match. The score is, in the series score, is 2-0 to England after a one-sided third test, a weirdly one-sided
Very
third
one-sided.
Test. Rod Marsh and Dennis Lilly's gambling efforts just nowhere near enough to offset the ridiculous heroics of Botham and Willis in that famous test match. So as I say, yes, the fourth test match now. Dan will give us a quick rundown of what actually happened in the match before we get into our nominations.
Yeah, so England won the toss and they decided they'd bat first. And it was Captain Mike Brearley. He top scored for England. He reached 48. But a 5-wicket haul to Terry Alderman meant that England could only reach 189. A late day one surge for Chris Auld had Australia 14 for 2, but they recovered from there to take a 69-run lead on the first innings. Then Ray Bright tore through England's middle order in the second innings, dismissing Jeff Boycott, Graham Gooch and Peter Willey, but Mike Gatting rallied with a tail to help England reach 219 all out, setting Australia 151 for victory. This seemed very unproblematic at 105 for 4, but after John Embury dismissed Alan Border, Ian Botham sprung into comic book action, taking 5 for 1 in 28 balls to bowl Australia out for 121 as England won yet another impossible test.
But who will win the ridiculous test? That's still to be determined. I'll nominate first, if that's all right, because I've got one of our team selection, team setup nominations, which I always quite like because it kind of betrays the thinking of the team, as it always gives you a sense of how things... So England have won the previous test, and far from going with the don't change your winning side, they brought in a spinner. They've done multiple things, but the nomination for me is England's third number three in four tests and the associated shenanigans stemming from that. Just to recap how things had gone over the series with number threes. England began the series with number three problems and frankly hadn't resolved. In the first test, they recalled Bob Woolmer, who they'd previously dropped for slow scoring, and he made a pair, which very fine. He did do a great deal better in the second test, and so when Mike Brearley came back into the side, he brought his lamentable test batting record to the number three spot. He made 10 and 14 in that match. Which was a better return than Graham Gooch, who'd made 0-2 opening the batting. So what England did for this match is they dropped Gooch down to 4 and promoted Brearley to open it on the basis of his 10 and 14. And as I was watching it, this was actually quite hard for me to take in because Gooch is so firmly categorised in my brain as an opener and Brilli is so firmly categorised as not an opener. I saw the team on the highlights and I just didn't accept it and immediately came up with this alternative explanation that they were just showing the England 11 alphabetically. So it was Boycott and Brayley at the top, then Gatting, Gooch and Gower and Willis at the bottom. And it took me a minute to realise, you know, it seemed plausible and I was happy with that. But then they walked out and, yeah, Brayley was opening the batter, rejig. So with Brayley up top and Gooch at four, David Gower became number three. And David Gower promptly made a duck to prove that it was almost something to do with just the batting position rather than whoever inhabited it. But second innings, he made 23, which qualified as real riches for a number three for England in this series. And the other flip side of this is that Brayley made, as you say, Brayley made 48 in England's first innings and actually emerged with the highest score of the match somehow. So kind of a triumph.
A very low scoring match, yes. But yeah. 48 is an impressive top score in a test. Must be one of the lower top scores in a test there's ever been.
Yeah, and probably one of the only ways that Mike Brayley could be top scorer in a test match as well, really.
Yes, yeah. I've got a little bit of hindsight corner here. Because, I mean, in retrospect, I mean, England do go on to win this series, and it's a famous series. So you'd kind of like to have as part of the record this kind of greater air of calm about team selection. But that's not the case. This is just chaotic shambles. This is, we're just going to pick whoever we can find and we'll hope for the best. So does it give you this sense of, you know, this is all calmly preordained?
No, there's many ways to win a series. Yeah, and they're making up as we go along, the philosophy, which, to be fair, they pretty much stuck to for a decade or two afterwards because it was the template for success to just tear it up and start again after each test match.
Yes. All right. So that's a very good nomination. My first nomination is Kim Hughes' close in fielding and other general Australian shithousery. So you'll probably be stunned to hear this, Alex, but the Australian team were indulging in all kinds of shenanigans during this test. And I will get to my favourite aspect of it, which is the one I mentioned. And it's one I don't think I've ever seen before. But I'll run through some of the, you know, the classics that they fell back on earlier in the test. So there was, of course, you know, the disputed low catch very early on, a classic same old Aussies moment with the slip fielder claiming it but given not out by the umpires. Then we had Ray Bright. He came in as the night watchman at the end of the first day. And he spent a lot of time wasting time, as night watchmen like to do. They like to fart us about and see if we could get through to stuff.
It was a kind of a Stuart Broad-esque performance, yes. Really, Bright's night watchman. Just generally being annoying and wasting time. And yeah,
changing his shoe, adjusting the side screen. The classics. He got a bit of a talking to for the umpires about that. And then so that's all pretty standard. After that, we start to get into some more unusual territory. So at what point, and you'll remember this is kind of the days where pretty much most of the batters don't have helmets. So Bob Willis is running in bowling at God only knows how fast he's bowling, and he bounces Kim Hughes, who has no helmet on. And Hughes kind of guides it past slip for a boundary. And then to kind of celebrate this shot, he walks up to Willis and starts applauding in his face, which is very funny. According to Richie Beno, Dickie Bird had to step in at that point to say, cool it. But I'm not really sure why. I think it's quite entertaining when a batter applauds a bowler for bouncing him. And then, as you'd expect, Dennis Lilly showed up on the scene and things got even more hot-headed at that point. So Lilly somehow got entangled with Bob Willis while thinking about a second run. He turned back and Willis was coming back to his mark and the two, you know, did a bit of a dance with one another and Lilly gesticulated angrily. Then he got a talking to from Dickie Bird about running on the wicket. And he basically just went, you know, from England player to player, from England umpire to umpire, just taking it in turns to engage in arguments with all of them. He was having a great time.
Little snapshot of a career, really.
Yes. But none of those are my actual nomination. My actual nomination is Kim Hughes fielding in close to Geoffrey Boycott. So this is when Ray Bright is bowling to Boycott and Hughes is right at the edge of the pitch, like as close as you can feasibly get while not being on it. One of those ones where, you know, they're crouched as low as they can, just hoping that they'll catch a defensive prod on the way down from the bat. It's one of those positions. Yeah. But that's not all he's doing. He has another trick up his sleeve. So as Bright delivers the ball, like as his arm is coming over and letting go of it, Hughes is kind of jumping like a little frog. He he's just kind of hopping forward a few inches, pretty much onto the pitch as Boycott's defending it. And you might think, all right, that's very strange behaviour, but it's not a one-off tactic. He does it over and over again. The umpires don't seem to stop him for a while. He just keeps doing it. And Boycott gets very annoyed. And around about this point, you know, the umpires do step in, I think, and say, all right, probably enough of the hopping like a frog onto the pitch under the batter's eye like him. So, yes. I mean, at no point, as I mentioned, does anybody sing about how the Aussies were always cheating. But I think if they'd started up at that point, I might have got along with it because I'm not really sure that's on from Kim Hughes.
I mean, what was particularly masterful about Hughes' tactic is it's so like unique and eye-catching and distracting that once he's done it a couple of times, it then you're waiting for it to happen. Yes. And it then becomes distracting when he doesn't do it. Or even just you're trying to work out like what's the timing of when he does the mad little hop, like is it as the ball's in the air, is it the ball as the ball's pitching, so you're sort of watching for that as well. Yep. And I think he mixes it up a little bit. It's not like a real rhythm thing, he's just hopping about like a madden.
Yeah, it's very funny. It's well, it was one of my favorite moments of the entire test.
Okay, well, I'll move on to my next nomination, which is something a bit of a recurring theme of this series. It's Return of the No Ball. And again, I need to give a bit of backstory here. So Bob Willis had been dropped for bowling no balls the year before.
I love that, by the way.
Yeah, drop for bowling no balls. It's like a real... regardless of the quality of bowling, it's just not worth picking. Yep. You because you're not going to bowl enough legal deliveries. And yeah, in the second test, he'd managed to bowl 28 in one innings. So that seemed to support the previous move. But then in the third test, Mike Brearley famously told him not to worry about bowling no balls. And he responded by not bowling a single one.
What a contrarian.
So in this test, I can only presume that Brearley went up to Willis and said, you really should start worrying about no balls again. Because he just delivered heaps of them. It's quite a hard thing to measure, though, because as we previously established, the way that no balls were recorded then was they went down as no balls if no run was scored, but if a run was scored off the bat, it just went down as a run and everyone forgot about the no ball. So we can see from the scorecard that England bowled at least 21 no balls, and these were mostly from Willis, judging by the highlights. And yeah, I mean, you can sort of judge that it's a recurring theme just from everyone else's behaviour. Like the commentators are obviously remarking on, oh, there's another no ball, he's in a terrible time and things, but the crowd are really, really like giving him grief or like moaning or groaning or cheering. And then I have a theory as well. You know, the Hughes applauding Willis. I actually wondered if that was for not bowling a no ball, because it was right in the thick of a real no ball spell.
I mean, it could probably be both things, right? I mean, Hughes was probably just itching for a fight at that point, so as most of the Australians seem to be. I did like that at least three Australian batters got off the mark with a no ball. So Wood, Border and Yallop all got off the mark from a no ball that was bowled to them, which is probably, you know, very generous of Willis and co.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a measure. Like, they showed those as being, you know, bad at getting off the mark.
Yep.
Those invisible no balls that don't appear on the scorecard, that's probably just a measure of how often it was happening.
Yeah. All right. My next nomination, then, is Australia's dreadful running between wickets. So this kind of almost segues perfectly from your nomination, because Australia got off the mark in this test with a quick single off a no ball, as we mentioned, to get off the mark. But it was such a almost suicidal single that they almost got run out and then got an overthrow from it, as it turned out. So good running between the wickets from Australia, trying to you know, lose their wickets even with the no balls that Willis was sending down.
That sequence of events, no ball, almost a run out, overthrows, is last over of a one day international territory, not sort of first over of a test innings territory. That's what marks that out as being striking.
Yes, that's very good. And it was mostly due to Graham Wood, who I know this from childhood. Graham Wood was a terrible runner between the wickets. This is one of the things I know in my bones. I don't really know how I knew that, but it's just like a truth that has been part of me for as long as I remember. And I did do a little bit of research that kind of justifies where this truth comes from. And it arises from the previous Ashes series in 1978-79, where Wood opened the batting in six tests, and in each of those tests, either he or his partner was run out, which is just an astonishing effort. And I can understand why that might give you a reputation as a bad runner between wickets, and why it may be a tricky reputation to shake. I do also like that when we get to the 1978-79 ridiculous Ashes, not sure when that'll be, I've got this as kind of in the bag here. This is going to be quite literally a running nomination for that series. Anyway, pretty much inevitably, Wood ran himself out in the end of this innings. He hit it straight to mid-off, took off for an imaginary single, didn't make his ground. The fielder at mid-off just threw it in, hit the stumps, and that was the end of him. But that didn't bring an end to Australia's terrible running between the wickets. We also had Martin Kent showed up. He was batting with Graham Yallop at one point, and they had a bit of yes-knowing, and somehow England failed to run them out. And then Rod Marsh came in to join Martin Kent at one point. And again, there was even worse yes-knowing, where they're both halfway down the pitch staring at one another before retreating back to where they came from. And again, there was no wicket. So England combating Australia's terrible running between the wickets with not particularly great fielding. But there was one more run out in that first innings, and this was the glorious Rodney Hogg without facing a ball. So I think that's from the very first run they scored to the very last run they didn't score, Australia's first innings run outs is my nomination.
Just going back to Graham Wood with his reputation for indulging in run outs, I can forgive him a little for perhaps being a bit of a creature of his time, because we've seen a few run outs yes. given and not given in this series. It seemed like decision making was a little haphazard, where the batter was several yards short of his ground, and even the commentators watching replays have concluded that he was just home or maybe an inch out. It was like everyone's judgment was massively impaired. So maybe he was just playing the rules of the time, which is that, if you're within a few meters, that it could be in or out. Who knows?
Yes. So counteracting that, the 78-79 Ashes was a home series. So I would have thought he might have got the benefit of the doubt. Based on what was going on. So
I have a theory that maybe he did he perhaps call like based on his own name rather than yes no, he would like give a conditional would and then leave it for the other batter to conclude under what circumstances.
So the other batter's just going wouldn't. Yes.
Okay, my next nomination is Beefy taking 5-1.
Yes.
So the scorecard doesn't really suggest this, but Mike Brearley reckoned this was a good pitch to bat on throughout the match, and that England had thrown wickets away gratuitously in the first innings. That was the word he used. Mm. I have a theory here that Brearley concluded that any pitch on which he could make runs must by definition have been an absolute road, and didn't take in any actual facts. He just thought, well, I've made 48 on this. This must be, flat as a pancake.
Yeah, I've top scored on this.
This must be easy for like an actual batter, but whatever the reason, he thought that even though they'd set Australia a slightly bigger target, which is 151, than in the previous test, this was an easier chase than Headingley given the conditions. All the same, Australia made pretty heavy weather of it early on, and they'd reached 105 for 4, the kind of inch there, but they were 46 runs from victory. At this point, on commentary, Richie Beno said, and this is a very Richie quote, it's almost ridiculous to contemplate 6 wickets falling for 60 on a track where the ball isn't doing very much, but contemplate it we must because of the stirring events of Headingley.
Yes, very good.
You don't get these sort of grand proclamations from commentators these days. It's very sort of stylized.
Contemplate it we must.
It we must because of the stirring events of Headingley. So 105 for 4, but Australia weren't actually losing wickets very often because it had taken them 50 odd overs to get to that point. They'd really been like snailing along, and as you said in the rundown of proceedings at the start of this, Embury then got Border for 40 off 175 balls, and it was at this point that Brearley stuck both of them on at the other end. And he reckons both of them have been reluctant to bowl up until this point because the pitch wasn't doing a lot and he couldn't really see any way of getting anyone out. So he was saying, oh, Peter Willey should bowl ahead of me. And there are all sorts of stories about how he wasn't even going to put his bowling boots on at the start of the session until Brearley instructed him to. And I don't know like whether these are sort of rewritten, but it does seem the case that both of them was reluctant. He'd not had like great returns in the first innings. Yep. And yeah, he didn't seem keen to bowl. But Brearley persuaded him and he took 5 for 1 in 28 balls,
yep.
Which in terms of like expectation and what actually eventuated, there's a pretty marked contrast there. So Australia went from 105 for 4 in like a couple of sessions of like slow batting to 120 all out in about a half an hour of cricket. It was intense.
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty much like the second part. This is the 1-2 punch, right? Because every single Australian cricket fan from this point on was just terrified of the prospect of what Botham might do for the rest of his career. Even when he was an old doddering has-been who couldn't do anything, yeah, the fear, and I'm capitalizing that, the fear remained because this is Botham could do, he could, you know, bat you out of the game, he could bowl you out of the game, he could do pretty much anything. And as I mentioned in the very first episode of this series, I didn't watch this series live, but again, after this, I still knew that, you know, Ian Botham was the boogeyman. He was coming to get you, and you were never safe while Ian Botham was around.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely took a lot of wickets purely by being Ian Botham in later years. I mean, yeah. you see the photos of him and he doesn't look sort of like a lithe swing bowler, late stage beef. But this wasn't quite like that. The third wicket, I will point out as being absolute filth. Lily really went out of his way to edge what could have been a wide. But mostly they were proper wickets. He was bowling pretty straight. They were mostly bowled, but I think Terry Alderman was out or almost out to all three deliveries he faced. So yeah, it was a pretty solid stint of bowling, as you would expect for 5 for 1.
Yes.
But I'm saying it wasn't just chaos.
Yeah.
It was a lot of stumps going down. But I guess this is really establishing that nagging Australian fear of Beefy. That last match in this.
Yeah. Yes. Very very annoying man. From an Australian perspective.
He's, a mixed sort of attitude to the UK as well, depending what you're talking about. But,
yes.
Cricket-wise, yeah.
Yes. All right, my final nomination is Ray Bright's LBWs. And I'd just like to mention, as I start this nomination, that Ray Bright is now my new favourite cricketer. I love everything about Ray Bright. He's an absolute hero, and I love him. I didn't really know anything about him before this series started, and now I just adore him. So the LBWs, to be very clear, the ones I'm nominating here are the ones while he was batting. So in the first innings, he was batting, and he was LBW to Ian Botham. And the thing I like about this one was that he was LBW with both feet in the air. He was jumping for some reason, and when the ball hit his pads, neither foot was on the ground, and he was somehow still out LBW, which I just adore. This is fantastic stuff from Bright as the night watchman. And in the second innings, he was out first ball to, you know, one that may not have been strictly in line with the stumps, but at this stage, both of his so irresistible that it doesn't matter. It hit you on the pad. It's close enough. The umpires are definitely giving this because here we go. The prospect that things are going to go very badly wrong for Australia gets even more serious at this point. Because at 114 for 6, which is what they were when Bright came in, They should have been still fine chasing 151. Bright made 27 in the first innings. Martin Kent had been batting for an hour. They should have been able to squeeze 37 ball runs out of the tail, but Bright goes first ball and it is just complete panic stations. Like, they're no hope. Their minds are gone. They saw what happened the previous test. It's just going to be even worse this test. So they're what happened to him LBW when he was batting. When he was bowling, he has no chance of ever getting an LBW. And this is one of the great things about the LBW law, because he had match figures of 7 for 88, excellent figures. 4 of them were bowled, and it was virtually impossible for him to get an LBW because of the previously discussed angle with which he comes into bowl. So he's always pitching it outside leg stump pretty much when he's bowling to a right-hander. And so in the first innings, he got Willie bowled behind his legs, turning out of what was described as rough on day one. So I'm not quite sure what was going on with the pitch there. And then in the second innings, Bright just tore through the top order. He's bowling like an absolute wizard, knocking stumps over. Got the occasional catch. And then he got the last recognised batter in Gatting, and he bowled him around his legs, which I'm pretty sure Shane Warne never did. So I therefore conclude that Ray Bright is a better bowler than Shane Warne ever was. Took 5 for 68 off 34 overs in that second innings with 17 maidens. So congratulations to Ray Bright.
I mean, you say that he had that run-up, but he never quite reprised that sort of jaw-dropping sideways crab arrival in the first start of the series, which, to be honest, is something that I kind of admire. Like, he just threw it in for an entry. Just, I'm going to make an entry.
Yeah.
And then I was just born up fairly normal after that.
A better showman than Warne, perhaps.
Well, discuss.
Well, I don't see Shane Warne coming in sideways and his first ball in Ashes cricket, or the first ball that I saw.
No. I mean, it may have turned sideways, but yes. It certainly didn't run in sideways, so missing the trick there. Well, I have nothing else to add to that. Should we skip through some unnominated moments? These are not up for points, but we like to highlight a couple of things we spotted. One little moment I really liked, which is just a very small thing, but there was, I don't know who hit the shot even, but Australian sort of hit a fairly straight drive towards the boundary, and England fielder went sort of chasing after it. And it wasn't like a super fast outfielder. I mean, the scorecard tells us that. And the ball definitely wasn't going to make it to the boundary. And I think they were just sort of jogging to or something. But then for some reason, David Gower sort of in hot pursuit of the first fielder. And he was never going to catch the ball before the other fielder. And it wasn't like the ball, it would have been like a sliding stop and flick it to Gower, and Gower throws it in.
Yeah.
So he's just going for a sprint for no clear reason whatsoever. And sure enough, you know, the other player picks it up and turns around and throws it in, and Gower's just sprinted for no reason at all. And it's particularly weird because I always think of Gower as someone who's got real economy of movement. It was never like hair to the boundary without good cause. I don't know. I don't know what he was up to there. But it was so obvious. I can't sort of describe how obvious it was that it was pointless from the outset. But he did it anyway.
Maybe just had some excess energy.
Just trying to warm up a bit.
Yeah, possibly. I've also got a little bit of hindsight corner here from the commentators, Tom Graveney. And at one point he says, there's no doubt about Ian Botham flashing hard. Which, if you're a long-time user of Twitter.com, you may interpret that comment in a different way.
I don't usually like leaving these sort of things unelaborated in case people don't know what we're on about. But in this instance, I feel like we should just move swiftly on.
Yes. It's probably for the best. And the last unnominated moment I've got is Rod Marsh took a catch off Bright, and Richie Beno suggested that he was taking a victory lap of the ground for this catch, which, as far as I could tell, was pretty much, I mean, it was an okay catch. You know, edge off the spinner, gloved it cleanly, good work. And the thing I'd most like about this was that it's in stark contrast to I think it was the last wicket he took in England's first innings, where he just leapt across in front of first slips to take a catch off a fast bowler, rolled, got it back up, just, you know, started walking off. Not a single person made a fuss about it. So Rod Marsh is anything diving about for a fast bowler, that's run of the mill. If he takes anything that deviates half a millimetre from a spinner, it's just like, oh, we've got to celebrate this one big. So I think that tells you where Marsh's strengths as a keeper were, perhaps.
Yeah, I think it was in this match. There was one sort of down the leg side, maybe off, I don't know, it wasn't out, but it maybe came off the bat or something. It was just absolutely miles. I don't know how far he travelled to reach it. Maybe it was the previous match, I don't know. But yeah, he was really covering some ground.
Yes, he'd like jumping around.
Like a frog?
Like a frog, which I think brings us up to our votes, right? Because I'm very much... putting Kim Hughes jumping like a frog in close as my strongest nomination here. I'm arguing very strongly for that getting 3 points.
Yeah, it's a really unique... I mean, fielders in close always look pretty silly, but they usually remain pretty stationary because, you know, the time to react is so small anyway. The last thing you want to be doing is sort of moving around. So
yep.
I can only presume it was, as you say, Australian shithousery.
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, Beefy's 5 for 1 is obviously a timeless classic.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I could probably really put up against it.
Yeah, but, you know, he performed his heroics at the previous test. We've seen beefy heroics.
You're saying that beefy's previous heroics.
How often do you see Kim Hughes jumping like a frog?
That's true. I've never seen it before, whereas beefy heroics, literally every single test match is run-of-the-mill by this point.
Yes. I'm willing to give you 2 points for Beefy's heroics, but I really want Kim Hughes jumping like a frog as 3 points.
This is where the Ridiculous Ashes differs from the actual Ashes in terms of what it deems important. Kim Hughes hopping like a frog being the real standout moment of this match.
5-1, nah, that's fine.
Anything sort of animal-like, like Ray Bright running in like a crab. You're trying to get through the whole animal kingdom with all our top nominations. Well, on that basis, I'll concede because I like the idea of it as much as anything else. And Beefy second. In which case, we're fighting for either a draw or an Australian win here with our final vote. I think my nobles is a little bit feeble in that I've already kind of had it before.
All yours are repeats. It's number threes. It's Beefy.
I suppose it is. Yeah. I thought this particular number three, these shenanigans were particularly good, particularly with Mike, the element of Mike Brearley, like getting promoted to opener on the basis of, getting into the team on the basis of nothing, doing nothing, and then getting promoted to opener. Because, like, what? He's the best man for the job. He was sacrificial number three. Now he's sacrificial opener.
And don't forget, somewhere in there, he also got promoted to captain as well.
Well, yes.
Very, very entertaining. I guess my second best one is I do enjoy Ray Bright being LBW while jumping in the air. I've got very leaping based nominations for this particular test. So jumping in the air and still being LBW, I think is probably my second best nomination. So it's probably between the number threes and Ray Bright hopping about as well.
Can I not argue that you've already had jumping as a nomination? You're repeating your jumping nominations within the
That's
same.
That's a fair
point. Wasn't even the best feat of jumping in this match, let alone.
This is true. All right, so what are we gonna have here? We're gonna have the number threes.
I'm gonna argue quite forcefully for the number threes, I think.
All right, I think I've got away with one leaping nomination.
Well, I'm saying number threes, but it's number three and opener, really. It's Mike Brearley. It's Mike Brearley's contribution to this number three thing, just vacating the seat and gifting it to David Gower, who delivered a duck. I think there's probably more dimensions to the number three opener shuffling than there are to Ray Bright.
I think I'm fine with that, especially considering how close they got to this alphabetical order batting lineup too. Because the odds of getting an alphabetical order are, you know, infinitesimal. Like 11 factorial, it's like virtually impossible. So
I don't know why they brought John Embry back. Oh, because it's great. And Daly was, I don't know. Anyway, Chris Auld was a good player. You need more lower order, lower letter bowlers is what you're after.
Yes.
Late alphabet bowlers.
I do enjoy that. I think getting, you know, even half your team in alphabetical orders. Pretty bloody good, really. So, yeah, I'm willing to concede that. So I think that makes it a draw, right?
Okay, I think with some firm reasoning on our scoring here.
we're getting a little bit punchy at the end of the series here.
Yeah. Well, you say the end of the series. We've still got two tests.
Still two to go. God only knows what we're nominating for the fifth test.
All we know is it'll be animal-based.
Yes. Yes. Well, there is one way to find out what we will be nominating for the next test. That is to subscribe to our podcast on the podcast store of your choice. And while you're doing that, you could also give us the honest 5-star rating. And that will ensure that you will get it the instant it drops. And that will probably be in a week or so, because that's when we'll be back with our coverage of the fifth test of this series. Until then, you can check out Alex's website. He's at kidcricket.co.uk. Mine is leibcricket.com. We're thereabouts on various social media, at Ridiculous Ashes, at The Kigs Tweets, at Leib Cricket. Have a search, you'll find us. And thank you for listening, and we will speak to you all next week.
See
you.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2.
We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.